So the title of the talk tonight is Seeing Our Life with Dharma Eyes, the Eyes of Dharma. And the word Dharma has been around and it feels like quite a big story. And so tonight I'd like to kind of explore with you what it means. What is this Dharma? And it's a time when we can learn a little bit. Learning and practice really do go together. So the talk doesn't necessarily need to be very practical, but at the right time it can inspire the practice and we can say, that's what I'm experiencing right now. So the word Dharma, as you may know, is the truth of things, the way things really are, looking deeply, and the path through which we look deeply, the path that we travel. The spiritual journey is also Dharma. And there's a whole crowd of other meanings, which I won't go into right now. It's one of these huge words. What we're doing here, mindfulness, we're sitting hour after hour after hour, quietly, when people outside think we're totally crazy. Looking, that's what we're doing, looking at our life, looking at our experience. And there is a basic issue that when we look at something, we look at it through the lens, adasha, the lens or the filter of our conditioning, what we built and call the world, and what we are trained and learnt. On a very basic level, we learn that a tree is a tree, and a hand is a hand, and how to read a word, and we learn. So that's the filter. And as soon as we open our eyes and look at ourselves, we're actually seeing illusion. We're seeing what we learnt to see. And we're seeing through the filter of our experience up to now. And mostly we don't know it. And the reason is that mostly in our life, we have very quick look at what goes on. Like, I need to make supper. Oh, it worked. Oh, it doesn't work. We don't sort of look at the process of stirring the food and who is doing it and what is my consciousness as I'm making supper and what are the stories I tell myself and the judgment, it's good, it worked, it didn't work, it's not tasty. We don't notice it. We're looking at every moment in a very quick summary, sikum. I need this, I don't need that, this is working, this is better, I go here, I go there. So the retreat is where we stop and we cut through the summary, hasikumim, the quick look. This is this, this is that, this is what I need. Is there much of tzarich, that, that? And we try and look more deeply at what it is that we really experience. What is an experience? That's a very big thing. What is it that I'm experiencing right now? Not through the filter. Can we do that? So the Buddha taught that liberation is in the heart of experience. So what is in the heart of experience? So tonight I want to explore What isn't illusion? When we look more deeply at a moment of our experience, which can be a thought, which can be a fly on the nose, what does it look like when it's not illusion? The key teaching about this is the three characteristics. It's called three characteristics in the Pali. It's called the three seals. Chotamim, yeah. Chotmim is in the Tibetan, seals. And every experience that is more deeply seen will have these three in them. The nature of reality is the three seals or the three characteristics is the nature of reality. And our practice here is in a way to unpeel the kalef, to unpeel the illusion and see what's underneath. And what we see underneath, the best way of describing it is these three seals, three characteristics. And it's the image in the tradition is to take a, you find an object and it's made of mud. And then you begin to peel it and peel it and peel it, and you begin to realize that inside is gold. A little statue, pesel, katan, actually is made of gold. We never see it, saw it because it's covered. So it's an completely impossible thing to talk about it in one evening, the three characteristics. So I'm going to do an impossible thing and try and talk about three of them in one evening. Usually one of them is more than enough for a Dhamma talk, but I'll try. The first one is anicca, meaning arayut, in English transience, or everything passing, everything changing. Bar chaluf, is it chaluf? Yeah. And it's the experience that we may have touched already, and certainly it's been part of the instructions, that when we look at something, we see flow. So a quick look at a river would see a river. There's the river Yarden, the Jordan River. Nice. Jump in. When you look at it more carefully, you see that their river, as the Greek philosopher Heraclitus said, the river is never, can never be the same, even for one moment. That everything in this river is actually constantly moving and changing, and there isn't anything except movement. But a quick sikkum says, a river, I see it. The same with a hand. A quick summary says, hand. And I don't need more than that in order to hold something. A quick seeing would say, hand, for me to hold a spoon. If we stop and look with the eyes of Dharma, this hand opens and becomes a field of moving sensations and experiences and life, which never stay the same for one moment. Each finger is telling us so much about what happens all the time. And where's the hand? It's gone. The same with the thought. If we look at a thought, we see, oh, a thought, I'm thinking, where is amazing supper I just had? thanks to the amazing cooks. A thought. If you look at that thought, it's a package of so many experiences and memories and thoughts, and it passes, and we can't even actually see that thought because it's made of so many pieces. We can't actually see. What is this thing called, I had a good supper tonight? What is, where is it? What does it look like, this thought? It's made of light, it's made of energy, it's made of change. We can't see where it begins and where it ends and what next, and if it's one thought or five thoughts. Or the whole thing is like that. And all the stories that we tell ourselves in life, which are so powerful, the stories, the beliefs, the views, they're all like that. We have a story which we believe in. As soon as we really begin to look at it, it goes to pieces. It's made of so much, it's changing all the time. Everything we think of as a fact, uvda, cannot be a fact. It's just that our mind says it's a fact. But if we look at that mind that says, this is true, the whole thing is moving endlessly. So where is the truth? What is true? What is true is movement. Anicca. So all experiences have made up of other things, of made up of things. Everything is made up of other things. Everything, every object is also made up of non-object. A tree is made up of everything else in the world, not just, it's made of the leaves, it's made of the sun, it's made of the air, it's made of the earth, it's made of the, it was a seed and then it's become a tree. When does it start to become a tree? When was it a seed? Can we ever say it stopped being a seed and became a tree? This, now it's a tree? We cannot say. This tree is a moving, constantly moving object and made of everything else in the world. We don't like that so much because we want to have certainty. For example, we don't want to die. We just don't want to die. But it's illusion, because everything changes and we are born and we will not be here. So we change and we go back to where we came from, just like everything else. We're made of everything else. We are made of the rest of the world. We're not a thing separate. We're made of everything. So, but the self doesn't like that very much. It's threatening. But it's very important in our practice, because we have a experience that gives us trouble, like the back is hurting, or I'm tired, or the retreat isn't working for me, or I want to get up and leave the meditation. It doesn't help me, or anything. And if we look at it carefully, it isn't a thing, this back hurting, this feeling of tiredness, or this feeling of whatever, resistance or anger, whatever. And that really saves us, because if we see it, a painful back is made of life, our whole relationship with pain will change. We're meeting life, Dharma. We're not struggling with a problem called my back. There's a change in the view. It really helps our whole life. Anicca is really, really important as an insight that frees us. It's not a philosophy, although Heraclitus and other philosophers have talked about it endlessly, and quantum physics talks about it endlessly. The Buddha said somewhere, well, I'm beginning to doubt whether the Buddha said it, but someone told me that the Buddha said it, so I don't know. Maybe Ilan can help to But this is the quote that I heard. Let's say the Buddha said it, okay? It's okay. It'll be all right. It sounds as if the Buddha said it anyway. The quote is, it's very helpful to lead a spiritual life, but not as much as 10 minutes of unconditional love. It's very helpful to know 10 minutes of unconditional love, but not as much as 1 second of the true realization of impermanence, anicca. We get 1 second of the real realization of it, it's shattering and powerful. Just before the Buddha died, and this is very much in a sutta that I know, the Parinibbana Sutta, the last words before he shut up and died were, all fabrications, fabricated things, or all compounded things, in other words, made up of everything, is subject to impermanence. Practice apamada. Apamada is the word I mentioned yesterday. Practice erunut with dedication. The last words were on impermanence. All compounded things are impermanent. And then that was the last words he said. It's really important. And when we go deeper in this, it's a liberating experience because we begin to realize that, as in the images of the tradition, that every experience is like a line drawn on water. Kav matseyer v'mayim. Or a bird in the sky that leaves no track. Bli ekvot. A bird flying in the sky leaves no trace. And that every experience is like that. And it leads us to a liberated place and a timeless place, akaliko, no time, because everything is moving. And where is it going? It's going nowhere, it's going to more movement. And where is the beginning and where is the end? There isn't. So it leads to kind of a liberated place of timeless, thingless movement. But it also invites us to ask the question, if everything is changing, then what doesn't change? Is there something that is changeless? And this I'll leave to you. The second of the three seals is dukkha. Dukkha is the one we don't want. But I want to try and show you that we do want it. Dukkha is isipuk, dissatisfaction, translated not so well as suffering. Don't think it's a good translation. And it's obvious that we experience it in one way or another here every day. Something is missing. We experience it in our life as something missing. Something needs to be changed. Something needs to be fixed. I have to do something to get things better. I need to be better. Something else or someone else, this is, we're really busy with that, they need to be better. Dukkha, something missing. It's very obvious when we have pain, then dukkha becomes really, really clear and obvious that something is bugging me and unpleasant and I need to do something about it. The first noble truth of the Buddha, which is misunderstood, it's the truth of dukkha. But the Buddha didn't say, first of all, he didn't say, really, the word suffering is too much, it's too strong. Dissatisfaction is a better word, isipuk. But the Buddha didn't say that everything is suffering and that life is suffering. Life is life. But what the Buddha said is, if we are born into a body, we arrived in a body, we cannot avoid suffering. There will be suffering. We can't get away from that, because the fact of being born in a body means that we are going to be busy with survival, hisardut. We and every being, an animal, a plant, a insect, once born in a body, there will be an agenda to survive, lisrod. And that creates the suffering. So it will be there at some point, but it doesn't mean that all life is suffering, and it doesn't mean that there isn't joy, and it doesn't mean that when suffering stops, then it stops. When there's no dukkha, there can be sukha. Or where there can be no dukkha or sukha. Why not? Just being. Neither one, neither this nor that. So what's important? What's important to understand, and here is really an understanding, that dukkha is an expression of us being born into a form, into a body. It's an expression of being in a form and holding on to that form, surviving, wanting to survive. And it tends to control us. It tends to control our whole life. We tend to be busy with dukkha. And we think about the whole world around. Everybody's running like crazy to get more money, to get more health, to go on trips all over the world, to have more time, to have more relationships, to have more love, to have more anything, to more comfort, etc., etc. So much busyness to be more happy, to be happier than happy. So much busyness around dukkha. Dukkha projected into our life. So we really need to say, whoa, it's controlling life. I better take it seriously and see, what is this thing called dukkha? And then we begin to look more carefully. And what we do, we begin to see, is that we see our vulnerability, huh? Shavrirut shelanu, apigiyut shelanu. We begin to see it as a truth. This is where it becomes a truth, dharma truth. The truth of our fragility, our vulnerability. And that's an important truth, because instead of trying to fix it and trying to get more money and trying to get more this and trying to get more that, and just not, we look at the vulnerability and all of a sudden we feel, yes, it's okay. I can be vulnerable. It's all right. It's being born. And I can feel fragile. And I can touch it. And it's so much better to touch it instead of all the busyness that it makes of us, all our life, like a kind of ogerba magal, you say, hamster in a wheel going round and round, samsara. That's the busyness of trying to get out of suffering. And it's so much better to meet the source of it, our vulnerability, and not cover over, and not deny it, and not run away, and not being busy with it. So the power of dukkha is, it shows us where we are limited. It shows us the form of being born in a body and what it means. It shows us our thoughts. It shows us uncontrollable life, our uncontrollable mind that we can't control, our life that we can't control. It shows us some deep truth that life is in control, not me. And this is actually, when we get close to it, is a liberating truth. We find ourselves freed by saying, yes, that's the name of the game. Now I can start to live fully. So in the practice, it's important, because dukkha tells us, here is where you need to look. So it's where samsara, the conditioned mind, I talked about filter, where that, how that is. What is the filter? We experience it through dukkha. The conditioned mind, we experience through dukkha. The dukkha tells us, go there. So if you have tiredness, if you have, like I say, a back that's hurting, if you have a lot of crazy thoughts, if you have, I don't know, a struggle, if you have, you want to fix something and something has to be better, at that moment stop and say, ah, dukkha is inviting me to look at being born into a form and being in a form. A thought is a form, sura. I'm being invited to look at this form, conditioning, atnaya. I'm being invited to look at what gives me problems. Where am I stuck? Where am I struggling? The dukkha is inviting us to touch those places, to open those places. The dukkha says, like someone told me one time, the map of Treasure Island, Ihad Matmon, there's a little X on the map that says, dig here. Here is the treasure. Dukkha is telling us where to dig, because it's showing us where is our limits and where is our conditioned mind and where is our problem, what we need to really look at. So dukkha is invitation, and that's why it's valuable for us. So instead of, when we have a back is hurting, instead of seeing, oh, I can't meditate, my back is hurting, that's the place. The pain of existence is our invitation. There, dig here, chofer sham. This is the place to dig, because it's telling us what is the truth of being born in a body. What is the truth of my limits right now? What is the truth of my conditioned mind, hatoda'ah mutne? What is the truth of my dependence, tlut? What is the truth of my memory? What is the truth of being a person like this? And it's invitation, dukkha, so it's important. It tells us where to go, l'taher. Where to go, where to tahir. The biggest, because their book of Buddhist practice is called the Visuddhimagga. And the translation of it is the path of purification. So there is a model of the Dharma of purification, tihur, to clean the stuff. There is a model, it's a way of looking at what we're doing here, one way of looking. Certainly not the only one. But it is where we look. There is a famous story about one of the siddhas who started Buddhism in Tibet. So there is a book of 84 siddhas, and the 84 teachers that came from northern India and brought Dharma, Buddhist teaching, to India, to the Tibet. And each of them was a wild, crazy guy, and a crazy yogi, the Buddhist yogi that brought Buddhist teachings to Tibet. Well, one of them, his practice was working with pain. So while in India, he had a really, really strong pain in his thyroid, balutatris. And it was really, really painful, really painful. So he went to the guru and said, what shall I do? What shall I do? It really hurts me. And the guru said, stay with it. Just stay with it. Be with it. Look at it and come back in 1 year. So he did this. And then 1 year later, he came back to the guru and said, I can't take it anymore. The pain is filling my life. It's morning and noon and night. My whole world is full of pain. And the guru said, good, good. Now, imagine that pain is filling your life and filling the whole universe. And he came back a year later, enlightened and with no pain. He said, I expanded the pain till it filled the whole universe. Then, actually, I became the universe. The pain went. And it's kind of using the pain to expand boundaries, to go beyond the self. It tells us where to let go. When we meet dukkha, it tells us, let go here. There's something you're holding on to. That's the second noble truth. First noble truth is the pain. The second noble truth is why there is pain. There's something you're holding on to. Let it go, soften it, smooth it, meet it, understand it, let it go again, let it go again, let it go again. Again, it goes to a very deep place, working with dukkha. It goes, like I said, anicca goes to a very, very deep place of all experiences being like a line drawn on water and being timeless. Dukkha goes to also a very deep place of the end of suffering. The Buddha taught, all I teach is suffering and the end of suffering. So this is a kind of puzzle. What you mean to say, all the Buddha taught is how to end my back pain? That's the whole story? So I'm just here to, that's what I'm doing? But it has the opposite meaning. If all the Buddha taught is the end of suffering, it means Nirvana is the only end of suffering. He taught Nirvana. He taught liberation. And then what it means is only liberation is the end of suffering. It means only if you're a Buddha do you end suffering. And not being a Buddha is suffering, is dukkha. We're dukkha because we're not enlightened. It goes right to that place, which is very, very subtle. Even you could say the smallest movement in the mind, when seen clearly, the smallest creation of any form in the mind, a tiny movement, is already dukkha. It's already form and limited. And the unlimited is endless, is universe, is the universe. The minute we contracted mitkavets a little bit into a thought, that's already dukkha. So it goes into very, very subtle places of understanding of dukkha. And the third of the three seals is anatta, which is translated also not correctly as non-self. Because anatta isn't really no self, and it's translated even worse as emptiness, which it certainly is not a good translation. But it's anatta is not a fact of reality. It's about, anatta is more of a verb, shem poal, lo shem etzem. It's not a fact of reality. It's about no thingness, a quality, nothingness. no-thingness, a quality of unfindability. You can't find a thing when you look at it. It's exactly what I said about the hand. When I really look at the hand, I can't find a hand. If I really look at Stephen, I cannot find this Stephen. Where the hell is Stephen? Can someone tell me? I really don't know. I spent all my life looking for Stephen, I can't find him. Everyone tells me what Stephen is, but as soon as I look, I don't know where it is. Nevertheless, our experience is that there is a self, because who is doing this right now? Whose back is hurting? Who is talking right now? So as an experience, there is an experience that seems to be a self. And that is a truth. We can't deny it and pretend it's not there. And that's why words like emptiness don't really help us. Because they can be more illusion. They can bring more illusion. Because I feel like I'm here. But that's the beginning. Again, that's the invitation. What is it that I feel like I am here? What is that feeling, I am here? What is that I am that seems to be real? And the minute we look at it, it's quite helpful to look at the psychology or neurology that would distinguish two kinds of selfing. One would be the story that we tell ourselves. You can call it narrative self. I'm Israeli, I'm this age, I live here, this is my name, I'm healthy, I'm unhealthy, I'm old, I'm young, I'm like this, I'm like that. A kind of story that we tell. This is me and the story that I recognize. And then there is, under that, a kind of essential self, a basic self. You can call it a point of view, Nukuda Mabat. Something is looking from here to there. It's a point of view, the subject, subject-object, the subject, the subject. When we use the word in our practice, edut, witnessing, we're actually, the witness is the deeper self, which is looking at the story, the narrative self. The deeper self looking at the narrative self. So for example, the thought comes, what I need to do tomorrow is me in action. Developing a story. Me, what I need to do tomorrow. The witness that's looking at that is a deeper self. It's still a kind of a self because it has a point of view. The subject, the self is looking at the story. Our practice is to meet the deeper self, the witness self, and it's like being the audience, ha-tzofim, that's watching the hatzaga. The hatzaga is the narrative self, the story, is that what comes up, I like this, I don't like that, this is, and the witness is we're like the audience looking at the movie. It's very helpful to have that view that we're looking at the story of our life. And that's part of meditation. It's a really helpful, it makes a gap. So we're not on just automat all the time. So this gap of being the audience and not just the shakan, the actor in our life, but to watch our life, to watch the movie, is part of meditation. It's very helpful. But of course, it goes deeper. We can begin to see this deeper self, the witness, is still a self. And to know that is a much deeper place. To be the witness of the witness, if you like. But it's like to be a mirror. The mirror isn't a self. The mirror just reflects the world. So if we can imagine our mind as a mirror, that's a bit like going back even from that witness. The mind is just a mirror. Things happen to it, and it's not part of, it's not changed. The mirror isn't changed. It's just knowing. It doesn't really have a self. Anyway, that's too much in the air. But if we explore this anatta, this atta anatta, we can begin to see things just less personally. We can begin to see things less personal. We begin to see things happening in the body that are just happening. We begin to see the leaves in the tree are just being blown by the wind. They're just happening. The life in us is just flowing. There is things happening, but there's no one really behind them. And even in our body, the trushot, the sensations, am I really in charge? Am I the boss of this breath? Am I the boss telling my finger what to experience now? Is the finger doing, is my digestive system, arechet ikul, doing what I ask it to do? Or is it doing itself? So it's the self is, we begin to realize we take things less personally, that everything is, again, dynamic. The self is constantly changing. The point of view of the me is constantly changing. The self is a response to guva and not a thing. When someone says something to you, oh, you're stupid, up jumps the self. The self curvets big time. How can they say that? If you watch that, it's a process. The self is responding to a trigger and it jumps. It means the self is a response. We wake up in the morning, the self arrives, response to being awake. The whole night wasn't there. Morning, self comes back. Response to waking up. Slowly, 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 we begin to see things being bigger than the me. Things are happening. I'm not in control. Coronavirus arrives. The whole planet goes into hysteria. People are dying. Everything stops. Who did that? It's not us. It's just happening. We're all knocked over completely by a virus that we couldn't see. Who's in charge? Things are happening all the time. Karma is in charge. Things are just happening. And we can step back and see this big view. Everything is interconnected. Everything is relating to everything. And we don't need to kind of be the boss. It's illusion. So even the pains we feel, karma, we feel a pain in the back. We don't need to take it personally. We feel a pain in the mind. We say, it's me, I'm no good, I've got a problem. I give myself a hard time. It may be just voices that we've received in our life. And we say, it's me. We begin to own the problems. They're ba'alut. We own it, but we don't really need to own it. It just comes from samsara. It's not, we didn't design our life. We don't design our life. So again and again and again, we can see that happening, that we are freer than we think. We don't need to all the time be a person in charge and take it personally. I just gave a talk on this the other night, and I joked at the end of the talk. We're in the traffic, the Ayalon, and someone cuts us off. The self, from a point of view of self, would say, how can they do that? What a mum's there. He's cutting me off. He's driving badly. I'm very angry and pissed off. It's just what happens here, and I want to go to New Zealand. And but a non-self place would say, oh, they went there. Oh, it went there. I better put my brakes on. A lot of the understanding of non-self is this sense of, when we look for self, it's hard to find it. We keep finding transparency, shakuf. Things are shakuf. A thought is shakuf. If we look and see who's thinking that, it's obvious me. But if we look carefully at the thought itself, it's shakuf. There's no one standing there waving a flag. Stephen's thought, big flag. So we do need to look carefully at experience and look carefully at this illusion that the experience is owned by me, and I am in control of this action, this experience, this thought, this breath, this... Look at it carefully. It's really helpful to take our experience a little bit to pieces to do this. There's a moment of senses, achushim. There's no real scent, there's no real person there. We're just smelling the smell. We're just seeing the leaves. We're just hearing the sound of a bird. It doesn't really need a person so much. So we already know, if we're connected to the senses, chushim, there's less person there. When does the person come? When there's processing, ibud, tfisot, story. But we can see that when the person arises, when the story comes, when the labels turn up. The Buddhist teaching says that all the elements of experience, when they're seen properly, are like bubbles. Are like bubbles in the rain. And we can see, you know, when we look at an experience, take it to pieces. It's no self there. So it may be that it will help us a little bit I think two things in terms of practice. One is, don't try and look for no self. What's more to the point is seeing the self when it's strong and seeing the self when it's weaker, seeing the self arising when you have a desire or an interest, seeing the self being quiet when there's nothing need to do or nothing, no problem, or just listening to the birds, seeing the changes in selfing and looking carefully at all of those. We forget that we are, we forget to see the self because we're so busy with the self. We don't know how to notice the self because we're looking out of it. I don't know if that's clear, but we're looking from the self to the world. We don't notice that it's our self because we're, it's like someone who's sitting at home and doesn't know that they're home because they're looking out of the window. And they don't know that there's a home that they're sitting in because they're looking out of the window. We're like that. We don't notice the self because we're looking out of it. We're doing it. We're busy in life. So it's good to know that. And the second point I would like just to make, and it can help us in our practice here, it's really helpful to allow idea, not knowing, not having to know, to be a little bit less be okay with things that are not clear or not known. We want an answer. We want sibatiyut. We want to know why. We want to have the, this is because this. I feel this. Now I know. My doctor said it's because of that. We can allow things to be less known. And that's one of the nice places, a good place to live, actually. We're frightened of it because the self wants things to be clear and wants to know that tomorrow is going to be all right. That's what the self is busy with. So we're trying to get to know lots and lots and lots of things so that tomorrow will be better or good. But actually we can relax and be be in the not knowing. And that's a place to discover. So the three characteristics altogether are the Dharma view. They lead to, they are themselves not awakening, but they would lead to awakening. They will help us just to be with what arises and with what ceases. This is arising and this is ceasing. This is now arising. This is going. To be much more simple and much more deep with the moments of our experience. So thank you. We'll have one moment of quiet.